Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. Also, while you're over there, you can check out all the other content that 1517 is producing, all the articles that we're coming out with every day during the quarantine, the videos. You can go over to YouTube, type in 1517, subscribe to that, ring that bell so you can see all those Chad Bird videos popping up, all those conversations on the Decalogue that are coming out now, where Chad and Scott Keith and I are going right through the Decalogue. We're doing the very un-antinomian thing of actually talking about the 10 words from God, but, you know, it might be a little bit different than you think it is, so maybe go check it out. I mean, it might even be a little bit different than, I can't remember, Chad, when we went through the Decalogue in 40 minutes, which of course we've done, I don't think we spent as much time on each word as we do in those videos.
No, definitely not. What are we doing, like 25 minutes mm-hmm. per commandment, something yeah. like that? Yeah, yeah, no, we didn't spend nearly that much time. We've just grown in our knowledge so much over mm-hmm. the years. Mm-hmm. We have much more to say now.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, as we've gotten older, we're more familiar with breaking the commandments.
Right. We're drawn from personal experience.
Yeah, we have more to
all
say.
All these commentaries are autobiographical.
That's right. So, yeah, go check those videos out. They're all over there on YouTube. In fact, you got to go to YouTube to watch those. That's the only place they are. All right, Chad, how's the quarantine treating you so far, dude? My state is about to open up.
Same here. Yeah, I think our governor, Texas governor, just had a press conference. I think it was yesterday. Yeah, yesterday, where he said they're just going to let everything expire. And they're doing, I guess, like everybody, you know, phases. So mm-hmm. doesn't affect me a whole lot because I work from home. But it will make things easier. I mean, I got family members out of work. My wife's been out of work for weeks now. So we'll see what happens with dental hygiene and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, we're just holding steady.
Yeah, well, my haircut's a little more complicated than yours, so I'm looking forward to the soft open. That was on the list of things to get to open up pretty soon. So I think I got about a week left of this, and then I'll be able to go get this ridiculous thing on my head trimmed up.
Yeah, the buzz cut makes it a little bit easier to deal yeah. with.
Oh, I almost came out of this with one. My wife forbid it. She said, I don't have the right head, she said.
Well, it's always wise to listen to our wives, right?
It is, especially when they tell you, I don't want you to look that way.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Wisdom, let us attend.
She said, I said, a buzz cut's not bad. She's like, it's not the haircut. It's your tiny little head. So there's that. At least, I mean, I guess it's bigger than her saying your big huge head. She just
this
said,
is true. It yeah. could be worse.
She said my head's too little for that haircut, I guess.
Yeah.
We left Samson saying that this was all over. You know,
he's done.
Yeah, the conflict is done. There's going to be no more feuding yeah. with the Philistines.
Yeah, he's basically just going to live out the rest of his days under his vine and fig tree. Sipping wine, singing sonnets. That's the rest of his life.
Yeah.
Peaceful Samson.
Yeah, that's it.
That is until things don't turn out that way. Yeah,
the Philistines seem like they can't let this 300 fire tail thing just they're not gonna let that be the end of it, it doesn't seem.
No, they gotta get rid of him somehow. So Their next tactic, as we'll see coming up here, is to involve his own countrymen. You know, if it didn't work for them to take him out themselves, be like, yeah, well, maybe we can always enlist his fellow Israelites and see if they can help take care of the problem for us. So we left off in chapter 15 of Judges with verse 8. And this is after the whole foxtail incident where he burned up the crops and then he struck them ruthlessly. Literally, he struck them leg on thigh with a great slaughter, which is a phrase I think we should bring back into English. I mean, that's a great idiom. Somebody ask you, how'd the fight go? Oh, man, I struck them leg on thigh. It's probably a wrestling term, I suspect, something like that.
Yeah, I have no idea what that means.
I don't think anybody does. It's just just a Hebrew idiom, meaning he did them bad. I mean, he really ruthlessly, I guess, is a good a translation as anything. But that's what it says. He struck him leg on thigh. So he took him out with a great slaughter. And then for some reason, he goes and lives in the cleft of the rock of Edom. I don't know why he was living there. Maybe he just wanted a little bit of a, he does seem to be a loner.
Yeah.
So maybe he just needs some, a little bit of alone time, little Samson retreat there to the cleft of the rock of Edom. But he's not going to get much peace and quiet, because beginning with verse 9, we hear what the plan of the Philistines is going to be. So they more or less are going to force the Israelites' hand in this situation. It says they went up and they camped in Judah. So I'm assuming before this, they kind of, you know, they kind of kept their boundaries in place. The Philistines were ruling over the Israelites, but it wasn't like they were going in and raiding them left and right. At least we don't get that impression. But in this case, they do. It says they went and they camped in Judah, and well, my translation has they spread out in Lehi. ESV has they made a raid. I think made a raid is a little bit of a stretch here. The verb for spread out is actually an agricultural term. Like if you don't mow your yard or weed it or anything like that, it's going to become like overgrown, right? And this is what the verb means. It's a word that's taken from a field. If you don't tend to your field, it's going to get overrun or overgrown. And that's what's described here. So they spread out is what's going on here. In a place, the name is significant, Lehi or Lehi in Hebrew. And you got to know what it means to kind of capture what the story is all about. It means jawbone. So this is the story where we have a donkey jawbone that's going to be the weapon that Samson uses against his Philistine enemies. So, but that's the place. It's called Jawbone or Lehi. And then it says the men of Judah just are more or less asking the Philistines, what's up? I mean, why have you come up against us? And they say, well, because we want to bind Samson so that we can do to him as he did to us. So this is like the Philistines' version of the anti-golden rule. Instead of doing unto others what you want them done unto you, they want to do to him as he has done to us. I don't know exactly what they have in mind. Are they gonna tie a fire to his tail? Are they gonna burn him? What are their plans? We find out later what they actually do. But whatever it is they have in mind, they're wanting to get their revenge. So just you gotta almost laugh at the idiocy of this whole account. So instead of the Israelites like coming to Samson's aid, as happened with a lot of the other judges, you know, most of the time the judges, they weren't loners. They'd go out and they'd rally the troops, right? Hey, let's go fight the enemy. In this case, rather than the Israelites rallying around Samson, they rally in order to basically do the Philistines' bidding. So 3,000 of them, I guess, you know, strength in numbers, one against 3,000. 3,000 men of Judah, they go to where this cleft of the rock where Samson's hiding out. And they read in the riot act, don't you know the Philistines are rulers over us? What then is this that you've done to us? So, you know, why'd you stir the pot? Why'd you cause trouble for us? And Samson reveals that his philosophy is the exact same as the Philistines. As they did to me, so I have done to them. Yep. So they both got to live by the anti-golden rule.
A lot of eye for an eye going on here, huh?
Yeah, a lot of eye for an eye. Hey, they burned my almost wife and her dad, so I went out and I burned their fields. Eye for an eye, fire for a fire. So they say to him, well, we've come to bind you so that we may give you into the hands of the Philistines. It's like they tell him ahead of time. They're probably scared to death, I suspect. And Samson says, more or less, okay, right? Swear to me that you will not attack me, or some translations have kill me. So more or less, you know, promise me you're not going to do me any harm. I guess he wasn't worried about what might happen to with the Philistines. He just wants to make sure his own countrymen aren't going to take him out. And they say, okay, all right, we're not going to. We're going to tie you up, and then we're going to hand you over, but we won't kill you. Anyway, promise. So they brought out these two new ropes. We're going to meet ropes again, by the way, in the whole episode with Delilah. Same word that's used there. These two new ropes. And they tied him up and they brought him up from the rock. So that's the scene. 4,000, 3,000 men of Judah, they tie Samson up, two new ropes, and they start leading him down toward the Philistines.
That's a lot of guys to go get one guy.
It's a lot of guys for one guy, yeah.
That's how you know. That's how you know these guys are a little freaked out. Like, what do we need? I don't know. We go get this guy. We need a couple thousand dudes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it really shows you just how, not just how scared the Philistines are of him, but how scared the men of Judah are too. Everybody's scared of Samson.
Yeah, and it does seem like Samson, he's willing to go with them because Samson's not interested in like killing his own people.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to fight. He doesn't want to fight with them.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that is at least one mark in Samson's favor. He's at least all of the killing he does, at least it's not against his own countrymen.
Yeah, because
you know, we have had that happen with other judges.
I mean, he could have freaked out right then. Been like, yeah, you're not taking me. And then just had a big old fight on his hands. And he obviously, we're about to see, he's obviously not opposed. Or he obviously has no intention of anyone going through with this plan.
Yeah.
Right. But he's saving the resistance to this plan for somebody else.
Yeah, yeah, this is true. And they're gonna there's gonna be a lot of resistance going on in just a minute. So they bring him to this place called Lehi, which I mentioned earlier means jawbone. And the Philistines are just as happy as they can be. They shouted as they met him. It's like a war cry, right? They go out to meet him, and they think finally we have Samson. And then at that moment, as has happened before, God's spirit steps in. The spirit of the Lord rushed upon him or came upon him mightily so that the ropes that were on his arms were as flax that is burned with fire and his bonds dropped from his hands. So just like I don't know how big these ropes were or cords they tied him with, but just basically like tying up somebody with thread, just popped him right off. And then instead of pulling out a sword, instead of grabbing a spear, instead of using his sling or something like that, he looks around and he finds the kind of weapon that we would all use in a situation like this, the fresh jawbone of a donkey.
Yeah.
That's got to be a book title somewhere. You know, you mentioned that other book, like killing a lion in a pit on a snowy day. The fresh jawbone of a donkey.
Yeah, not to be confused with an old jawbone. This is
this is fresh.
This is a fresh one.
Yeah, this is probably I've thought about that. I wonder if this is another one of those cases where we see Samson just deliberately involving himself with a dead animal, right? We saw it happen with the lion, where he broke his Nazirite vow by messing around with the honey inside the carcass of a dead lion. And here we have him, you know, grabbing the fresh jawbone of a donkey, meaning that it was not old and dried up, but I guess from a recently killed donkey.
Who knows? They might have been like leading him around on a donkey. He might have been like, just ripped that jawbone right out of that donkey's face.
Yeah. Well, if he could rip a lion like he would a baby goat, I suppose he could do that to the poor donkey too. So he reaches out, takes it, and weaponizes it. And before you know it, there's 1,000 dead Philistines on the ground.
This is just crazy. That 1,000 guys. One of the things I think that this story is so nuts that you're like, wait a minute, this guy kills 1,000 guys with like he's just spinning in circles with this thing and just like wiping guys out as they like come at him. Yeah, who knows what's going on here? He must have had his back up against a rock or something where he couldn't get where they had to come at him only from one direction. But one thing that's interesting and you don't sometimes maybe you don't see it because the story is so crazy is that we've heard about donkeys before and people are always and all these other judges are riding on them, right? And they're riding these donkeys and then you're like, well, this is like a sign of power or royalty, that kind of thing. We have Jesus riding in on a donkey. Samson's a different kind of judge, man. He doesn't ride on donkeys. He slays people with donkey jawbones. And I don't know exactly what to make of that, but it could have been the jawbone of anything, and it's the jawbone of a donkey, and it's not as though donkeys are, this isn't the first time we've heard of donkeys associated with judges, but it's the first and last time we'll hear about donkeys in this way. And there's something interesting about as Samson as sort of this Christ figure that slays his enemies with a donkey jawbone, looking different than Christ, who, like, on his way to go slay death and the devil and hell and all this, rides into Jerusalem on a donkey. He's gonna go and do this on the cross. But there is this weird, I don't know exactly how to connect the dots, but there's some dots there that somebody could connect, I suppose.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I don't know exactly how to connect them either. I mean, if anything, it matches the unconventional nature of Samson, right? Like, everything he does, well, almost everything he does, is just like, is unlike the other judges. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's like them in the sense that he has this propensity to adopt Philistine ways or pagan ways. But I mean, he's got like an unorthodox judge in the sense that he's unconventional. But however those dots are to be connected, that is what he does. And I'm just picturing everybody just taken off, right? Because there's nobody else mentioned in the whole rest of the story. Like the people of Judah, who his captors, they take off. And presumably he would have killed all 3,000 of the Philistines if they hadn't taken off. He's only able to kill a third of them as it is. But anyway, that's what happens. And then, as most of us, I don't know about you, Dan, but after I kill 1,000 men, I usually write a little poem.
Yeah, I sing a little, sing I sing, it, I sing a little
is
song.
Is that what you do?
Yeah, a little song.
Sing a little ditty. Yeah, it's full of word plays. So this is the word play. So the Hebrew word for donkey and the Hebrew word for heap, like a pile, are homonyms. Or homographs, rather. Well, homonyms and homographs, meaning they're written exactly the same, and they're spelled exactly, they're said exactly the same. So like we have words like that in English as well. So when he says, with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, the word for donkey, chamor, is the same word for heap, chamor. So he's just making a little cute wordplay there. You know, Samson, he's all into wordplays and riddles and songs and renaming things. I've mentioned before, I mean, he might be kind of he's not just a big dummy. I mean, he is kind of creative. You got to give him that. He's pretty quick. I mean, if I killed 1,000 guys, probably the next thing I would do would not be sit down and be like, you know, I need to write a poem and it needs to have some good puns in it.
Yeah.
That's Samson. So with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I have killed 1,000 men. There you go. And then after he says his little poetic lines, he throws away the jawbone, and he named that place Ramat Lehi, which is Jawbone Hill. Pretty good name for it, I suppose.
That's a pretty good name. And as you were saying, so this place that this happens is, the word means jawbone, right?
Yeah. Lehi. Yeah, it means jawbone, so appropriately named. Lot of punning going on in this particular story.
Did it mean that before this? I don't know. I mean, that would be quite the coincidence, right?
Yeah, it would be quite the coincidence. I suspect not. It's probably one of those kind of retrospective sort of things where, it's named that because of this particular incident. So Jawbone Hill, there you go. And then it just kind of gets weirder and weirder, because the next thing you hear is that now Samson is extremely thirsty.
I imagine.
It seems odd. Yeah, I guess. I mean, he put out a lot of effort killing 1,000 Philistines. This is the first prayer by Samson, right? I don't believe that we have encountered. This is his first recorded prayer, I should say. So here's what he has to say. He became very thirsty, and he called Kara. That's important because of what we're going to hear in just a second as far as the name of the place. So he called to the Lord. He cried to him. And here's what he said. He says, "You have given me this great deliverance by the hand of your servant. And now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised? I mean, it starts out as a okay prayer, I suppose. I mean, he's acknowledging that God was the one who was at work to give him this great deliverance. And he calls himself the servant of God. But then he just kind of turns right around and in typical Samson fashion makes it sort of all about himself, right? I mean, I'm thirsty. And if it's like, if I don't get some water, I'm going to fall into the hands of the uncircumcised. It just seems a little bit strange to me. I don't think the uncircumcised is going to be looking for Samson for quite a while after that slaughter.
Yeah, well, it is a weird thing. I mean, he's basically saying, just kill 1,000 guys with a jawbone of a donkey, which is a pretty incredible feat. Are you going to really let the guy who did that die of thirst? That's not the way this guy has to. I can't go out like that.
I like that. Yeah. I mean, that would be a disgraceful way for a warrior such as myself to die. Well, if we say anything about this, we at least say, well, God is merciful, right? So he actually answers the prayer of Samson. God splits this hollow place at Lehi and water starts coming out of it. So Samson has his drink. He has his fountain right there. So he drinks, his strength returns, he is revived. And so never to let an opportunity pass when he can't speak a riddle or write a little piece of poetry or rename a place. He names this particular place Ein HaKoreh, which is the Hebrew for spring call or something like that. So this is, he called out to God, Kara, and therefore he names this place the spring of where I called out, something like that. And it's in Lehi to this day. And then we have this kind of strange ending to this chapter. It's strange only because it makes it sound as if the story of Samson is over, but it's not. It says, so he judged Israel 20 years in the days of the Philistines. Now, from what we know of the earlier chapters in Genesis, when you read something like that, you'd be like, oh, okay, all right, I guess that's it for Samson. But that's not the way it works here. That finishes off this particular section, but we have a whole other chapter coming up about the life of Samson, and we're going to have this same verse repeated at the end of it about him judging for 20 years. Don't you wish we had the whole story, like the life of Samson? Because what we have is so entertaining and so kind of out there that I can only imagine the exploits that he was engaged in throughout the rest of the 20 years. Well, I know you're going to be shocked by this, Dan, but prepare yourself. But Samson sees a woman that he likes, and so he takes her.
It's yeah.
Very, very un-Samson-like for him to engage in this behavior. But he does. He goes down to Gaza. So I mentioned in the last podcast that the Philistines had a Pentapolis comprised of, so, five cities. And Gaza was one of those cities, but it wasn't just one of them. It was the southernmost of those five cities. This is about around 45, 50 miles from Samson's home. So I don't know exactly what he's doing that far from home, but presumably he just kind of meandering around doing his thing. But he ends up in Gaza. And as with his almost wife, the first woman that he was going to marry, he sees her, right? That's the same thing that happened with her. So she was good in his eyes. He saw her. He liked her. He wanted her. So he arranged the marriage. In this particular case, though, it's not going to be a wife. It's a prostitute. So he goes to Gaza. He sees a prostitute there, and he goes into her, Hebrew for has intercourse with her. And I guess he stays the night there. There's a little bit of if you're following along, not in a digital Bible, but like a actual book Bible, you're probably going to have some footnotes or something like that saying the text here is a little bit ambiguous. It is. There seem to be some words dropped out here. And this happens a couple times in chapter 16 of Judges where there's some missing phrases where it's like it's incomplete in the Hebrew. And so what translators have done is they've pulled a couple of phrases from the Septuagint, which is the old Greek translation of the Hebrew, and they've kind of inserted those in there just to provide a more of a smooth transition. This happens on occasion in the Old Testament where it seems as if something has been just omitted for some reason, probably a copyist error. And instead, they go with the oldest translation we have, which is the Septuagint, and they work with that to kind of smooth things out in the translation. Anyway, what happens is the people of Gaza, the Gazites or Gazites, whatever you call them, they find out that Samson has arrived there. And so they surround the place where he's at. I don't know if this is like a brothel or just the home of the prostitute, whatever, wherever it is, wherever they are, they surround the place. They lay in wait for him all night at the gate of the city. Of course, that's going to be the only place of entry and exit was this gate. And you should know that I wish we were somewhere where I could actually draw this. It's kind of hard to describe in words, but the gates of the city weren't just a gate, but when you entered, or when you, we'll say when you exited, you were going through like a narrow tunnel-like structure, and on either side would be these guard rooms. So it wasn't like you just walked up to your front yard gate, opened it, and walked out. You would like enter into a narrow space, and on your right and on your left, there would be these small rooms where the guards would be stationed, and then you'd get to the gate. So it wasn't like he just walked up, opened the gate, and was able to get out. He would have had to pass by these guards. For some reason, there's no mention of guards doing anything in this case, but that's kind of the scenario here. So they're waiting for him, and I don't know, maybe they fall asleep, whatever it is. They keep quiet all night, and they say, here's the plan. Soon as sun rises, we'll kill him. Yeah, good luck with that. Samson wakes up at midnight, gets up, and he takes the doors of the city gate and the two posts, and he pulls them up along with the bars. I'm trying to picture this in my head. He puts this on his shoulders, and he carried them up to the top of the mountain, which is opposite Hebron. This is incredible. Hebron is 40 miles away from Gaza. So it's impressive, needless to say, that he's able to actually raise the gate of the city along with the post and put this on his shoulder. But to think of him then, you know, doing an ultra marathon from Gaza to Hebron, not just to go there, but to take it up on top of the mountain and deposit there is quite a scene.
Yeah. So he's walking for more than a little while.
And I have no idea why. I mean, we're not really told. Why not just like walk outside the city, throw the gate down, and walk away? But he goes all the way to Hebron.
With the gates, just in case they were wondering where he was at.
Yeah.
And, you assume the reason one of the reasons he pulls the gates up and stuff is that they're locked, and he just decides. Yeah. Of course, you're also like, if you can pull them out, you can probably just break them down. So.
Yeah, I suspect this was kind of a symbolic act, right? I mean, there's the well-known Matthew 16 quote that the gates of hell shall not prevail against the confession of Peter. And that, of course, is working with kind of the ancient symbolism of the gate of the city. That was really where the power was, right? In more than ways than one. The power was there because that was actually where the business of the city would be conducted. So we see a scenario like that in the book of Ruth when Boaz kind of does his negotiations about the redeeming of Ruth, happens at the gate of the city. So this is where business like that would have been conducted. This is where, of course, the guards were. So you had power there in that way, but then you also had power because this was like the most vulnerable part of the city, right? So you had to, if you took the gates, you took the city, more or less.
Yeah, I mean, this is why the term like storm the gates is a term. It's if you rip down the gates of a place, that you got it. I mean, this is, if you watch any, you know, medieval type shows or movies or whatever, you know, if somebody wants to take a castle, what's the or a city, the whole point of them having walls and gates and stuff was that you could have 100 guys in this city and you need like 1,000 guys to take it, because that's, but But if you don't have the, if you don't, obviously, it's because they have the this huge advantage, right? Of having, they got gates and walls, and if you just rip those things out, you've really, that's a pretty devastating blow in those days to a city. It's not like here. If you did something like that to one of our cities, it would be a bummer. But you haven't like put the entire city in, you know, city in jeopardy at this point.
Right. Yeah. You got to put yourself back into those times when most cities were walled cities, at least if they were any size, because these were dangerous times. So you had to have protection, and that most vulnerable part would be the gate of the city. So you take it down, or you burn it, or you sneak in like in the Trojan War and open the gates of the city for your friends on the outside. And it's basically over at that point. So he was leaving Gaza basically open to attack by doing this. So it was a symbolic move. And maybe that's why he took the gates all the way to Hebron, into his own territory, into Israelite territory, basically to symbolically say, hey, Israel, if you want to, you can take out the Philistines.
Yeah. A quick note about, you know, talking about the gates of hell not prevailing against the church. I mean, I've heard for myself for a long time, because I had heard it this way, it was sort of that, you know, hell will not prevail, you know, against the church. But gates don't attack. They're not like an offensive weapon, right? Mm-hmm. And what you realize is that the church storms hell. And that so it's the gates not prevailing is that the gates won't hold, right? So it's that the church storms the gates of hell. And obviously we have Christ descent into hell where, like, he does this. And of course, so when Samson does this, it prefigures a lot of stuff. So it's whether it's Samson as a type of Christ storming the gates, which of course Christ does, whether it's the church is the one, or Christ is the one, and Samson is the one on the offense, and the gate is supposed to be this thing. The gates keep people in, or they keep people out. Church does is we attack hell. Mm-hmm. That's what we do, and pull people out of it. Right? We knock the gates down, and those gates will not stand against the word of God. So there's more to it than just that, because you might be like, well, I don't know. Like, Samson's is like on the offense here, but even in that text, we're talking about that when we talk about the gates not prevailing, we're not talking about the gates attacking us.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great way to explain it. And it kind of reinforces the whole image of the church militant, right? Mm-hmm. We are marching. We are the soldiers of God, bear the sword of the Spirit. And you kind of picture the forces of evil hiding behind the gates of the city, right?
Yeah.
Hoping they'll be able to defend themselves, but they won't.
Well, if Christ's descent into hell means anything, it means that he has left hell vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. You know, a lot of the older teachers would use this particular story to talk about exactly what you were describing. They would describe Samson as a type of Christ here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's just as he tore down these gates of Gaza, so Christ tears down the gates of hell, which is another one of those striking typologies. Because I mean, why is Samson there? He's visiting a prostitute,
right?
Yeah, but I mean, just because there's immoral actions on the part of a character doesn't mean that he can't somehow serve as a foreshadowing of Christ. I mean, look at Jonah 3 days in the belly of the fish, right? Mm-hmm. He's running away from God, and yet that prefigures the burial in the tomb. Okay, so that ends that particular part of chapter 16. And now we enter into probably the most well-known part of Samson's story. Because it's been immortalized in, you know, songs and stuff like that. And interestingly, this is the first time in the whole Samson saga when one of the women in his life is actually named. We don't know the name of his mother. We don't know the name of his fiance. We don't know the name of the prostitute that he visited in Gaza. But we do know the name of the woman who ends up being his undoing. And of course, her name is Delilah. I suspect that there's sort of a wordplay that's intended here. When we started the Samson story, I mentioned that Samson's Hebrew name is Shimshon, which is formed from the Hebrew word Shemesh, which means sun. So Samson is like sunny boy, I guess you could say. It's a diminutive form, but his name is connected with the sun. Now, Delilah, at least the last part of her name, is the word for night. So you have Shemesh connected with Samson, the sun. And now you have Lila, which is the Hebrew word for night. So you kind of got this daylight, nighttime metaphor that's working between between these two. And it sort of fits too, because when does Delilah do most of her work? Well, when presumably at night, at least Samson's asleep when she engages in her various attempts to find out the source of his strength. But anyway, whatever, if there's a wordplay going on here, that's probably what it is. But we have the first named woman who's going to be part of Samson's life and ultimately part of his undoing.
Yeah, this is a complete aside and doesn't matter at all, other than in my mind, and maybe this is just from like, you know, storybook Bibles or something like that, but I always imagined Delilah having dark hair. And maybe that's just, you know, because you're like, well, she's bad, so she's got dark hair.
Right, right.
I don't know. But there's that woman that's been on the radio forever in the evenings, and she plays songs for people. She'll find the perfect song for your situation that you're in, named Delilah, right?
That's right, yeah.
And for some reason, I always pictured that radio personality also with dark hair because her name was Delilah.
Yeah.
And then, not that long ago, I saw a picture of her and she is blonde.
Oh, and it was ruined it all.
And I was like, that isn't right at all. Like that's...
Quick, color your hair. Yeah.
It's not, you can't be named Delilah and not have dark hair.
It's funny you say that, because if you say Delilah, that's the immediate picture in my head too. It's probably from all those children's Bible story books that we read. But yeah, that's my image. I mean I picture her as beautiful, even sure. though it says nothing about her beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And I picture her with dark hair. And it's just a little bit of a, you know, just a little bit of a sneaky sinister quality to her, which I of course does fit with her personality. Now it says that this is unique too. I know we're about out of time, so we won't get too far into this, but if my recollection is right, this is the only time that it is that love is attributed to Samson as a motivation, right? Yeah. So he sees the woman that he wants to marry and she looks good in his eyes, which that word good is it's ambiguous, but I mean it's kind of a general word. It could be translated as handsome or as beautiful, something like that. It often is in translation. But whatever she looked like, Delilah, he loved her. And he must have been like, he must have been head over heels in love with her. I mean, he must have been like engaged in kind of the stupid blind love, if you will, because as we'll see in the next episode when we pick up the rest of the story, I mean, it's hard to imagine a guy who's quite as blind as Samson not to realize what's going on here. Because, you know, she tries it once, she tries it twice, she tries it three times, and finally the fourth time she gets it right. You would think Samson would be on to this after a while as to what her real motivation was. But whatever reason, it's not until it's all over when he realizes that he might have loved her, but the kind of love that she showed to him is not the kind of love that anyone would want.
I think a lot of times this is pitched as sort of just this like lustful thing that goes down with Samson and Delilah, but there's not really a reason to think that. There's other language that it could use for that. Mm-hmm. If it was just I've heard people say like, well, he was, you know, but basically this is just some girl that he was sleeping with, you know, because like his marriage went bad, so then he goes to a prostitute. Now he's maybe got like a steady thing going mm-hmm. on, but it's just a, you know,
they're just hooking up.
They're just hooking up. Yeah. It's just all fornication and lust. But
mm-hmm.
but that's not what we get. I mean, you get from the text that Samson actually loves this person, which makes it more tragic.
It does. Yeah, I just was thinking that, because when he finally seems to find someone that he actually truly cares about, she ends up being the very one who just turns on him completely, and all for the sake of money.
And I have got loads to say about this next week.
Hold your ammunition, right?
That's it. Next week, we'll get into it. You don't want to miss it. It's going to be, well, we'll see how profound it is. But we'll see you then, Chad.
All right. See you then.